Hello and welcome to this podcast from Pivotal, where we're going to talk about policy priorities in Northern Ireland. So it's back to school this week for many children, and that means it's also back to stormont for our politicians as they return after the summer recess. So today we're going to talk about the big policy issues facing the Northern Ireland Executive as it returns. I'm delighted to be joined by a panel of experts from a range of backgrounds to help us talk about some of these issues. I'm pleased to welcome John Compton, former Chief Executive of the Health and Social Care Board and now a health consultant. Jane Thompson, who heads up Parentkind in Northern Ireland. Richard Johnson, Deputy Director of Ulster University's Economic Policy Centre. And Mark Huddleston, Chief Executive of JHE Solutions and former Northern Ireland Skills Commissioner. So I'm pleased to say that with that panel, we're going to have a broad-ranging discussion ahead of us covering health and social care, economic recovery, business, children and young people, skills, education, public finances, and probably lots of other things in between. So thank you to our panel for sharing their time and their insights today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. To introduce myself, my name is Anne Watt. I'm the director of Pivotal, the new public policy think tank for Northern Ireland. Pivotal was launched in September 2019 with the aim of helping improve public policy in Northern Ireland through promoting greater use of evidence in policymaking and engaging more people in talking about public policy issues. Pivotal is independent of government and not aligned to any political party. One of the things we aim to do at Pivotal is promote wide-ranging discussion about public policy in Northern Ireland. So this conversation today is one way that we're trying to do that. We hope it's a useful contribution to public debate. So what's at the top of the Northern Ireland Executive's priority list as it returns from recess? Obviously, COVID-19 has made the last 6 months extremely challenging for governments across the world as they've sought to balance protecting public health with sustaining economic activity. That's clearly been true for the Northern Ireland Executive, which of course was only restored in January this year after 3 years without government. The Executive returned to Stormont with some optimism at the start of the year and with a very broad and ambitious agenda for investment and reform as set out in the New Decade New Approach deal. In New Decade New Approach, there were commitments to addressing many of Northern Ireland's long-standing public policy challenges, amongst other things, reform in health and social care, an action plan to tackle health waiting lists, an independent review of education provision, a climate change strategy, turbocharging investment in infrastructure, and much else besides. The new executive was just getting settled in when preparations for dealing with COVID began in earnest. So the executive's work programme in the last 8 months has been almost entirely dominated by the pandemic, which has meant there hasn't been the focus on the commitments in New Decade, New Approach, or indeed Northern Ireland's longer term social and economic challenges that might otherwise have happened. As the executive returns from recess, what should its priorities be? It seems clear that there's a huge and challenging agenda, continuing to protect the public from COVID, dealing with the impact of COVID on the economy and different areas of public services like schools and education, but also starting to think about addressing longer term issues like low skills, innovation and productivity, underinvestment in infrastructure, and the need for fundamental long-term reform in public services, most obviously in health and social care. So there's a lot to talk about today in this discussion. Let's get stuck into the conversation. I'm going to speak first to John, given that health has been such a dominant issue over recent months. John Compton is a former chief executive of the Health and Social Care Board and also has been chief executive of several health trusts. He's now a health consultant. He specialises in change management at a strategic level and has led many transformational initiatives in Northern Ireland, including authoring Transforming Your Care, a comprehensive review to recommend and implement a major reshape in the delivery of health and social care in Northern Ireland. So in health, COVID is clearly the big immediate issue, but there are major problems in health and social care that predated COVID and have been made worse by COVID. Waiting list data released last week showed more than 136,000 people in Northern Ireland waiting more than a year for planned care, when the executive's target is that no one should wait more than a year. Only 11% of patients are being seen within the 9-week referral to treatment target. Meanwhile, reform in health and social care has been much discussed, including several high-profile independent reports, but actual change has been slow to happen. John, how would you describe the health and social care system in Northern Ireland before COVID hit? What challenges did it face?
I think it was in very significant difficulty before COVID and had been getting further and further compromised in terms of a service. It had a long period of no political leadership. And for the health and social care system, that's a real problem because as a major publicly funded service, it requires that strategic leadership. So having had several years of no leadership, you can just imagine that that has caused all sorts of difficulties. It was emerging from a very bitter industrial dispute, the first of its kind. We all tend to forget these now because of COVID, but, you know, lots of nurses and healthcare workers standing out on the street in very wet and difficult conditions, as I recall. And that's a sign of a service that's in difficulty because that was the first time that that really had happened in that way. Those workforce problems are not just about pay. They're about the numbers and about the ability of Northern Ireland to actually provide the numbers of people that are actually required in terms of health services. Even then, the waiting lists were pretty much out of control, and there was a lot of debate about people dying on waiting lists, and that system has remained, and that issue has remained. There was failure to deliver strategic change at any sort of pace, and there was a social care agenda which was really in considerable difficulty. How do we provide care for older people? Who pays for the care? What about our mental health services? What about our childcare services? All of these things were in their own way in some considerable difficulty. So we had a very difficult set of circumstances for a new executive to come in to look after as the year started. But it was a service in very considerable difficulty.
So that's the situation that COVID arrived into, I suppose. What's your assessment of how the health and social care system in Northern Ireland has handled COVID?
I'm sure there'll be many people who have all sorts of views about how they've handled it. I personally think they handled it pretty well. Of course, there'll be lessons to be learned. I'm sure there will be a review afterwards. But our deaths were lower and statistically in the population with other regions in the UK. Our intensive care wasn't overwhelmed, which was a really, really big concern and worry. And the communication in the round, I think, was quite good up until very recent times. Politically, that communication went pretty well. Now, there's always room for improvement. I think the reorganisation of services that was undertaken was pretty dramatic, pretty quick, pretty speedy. People were moved about, buildings were changed, all of that. And I think what it did, it reaffirmed that our health service is good at emergency care, but not at all good at elective care. And I think it is important to start to think of the health service against those two prisms. When you think about emergency care, even today, if you turn up at hospital, you know, from a bad road accident or with a coronary or something like that, you'll get very, very good care. If you're waiting for services, you'll get pretty average to poor care in terms of the waiting times, as far as all of that is concerned. I mean, I think there are some things that it had to learn about, and these are not just health things. I think the procurement chain was a real problem. When you get a big emergency like this, because everybody in the world, for example, was looking for personal protective equipment, and it was quite hard to get. And so I think there are things to be learned in terms of how we procure things. There are some things to be learned out of how the management of nursing homes and the services in nursing homes, how that occurred. Although I think that is quite a separate thing, and a lot of the stuff that I read wasn't particularly I thought straightforward or reasonable. You know, when you have got COVID in a society, you can't bar it from any building in that society. And when it gets into a nursing home where you've got old or frailer people, then you are inevitably going to get deaths. It's just an impossibility to avoid. And I think also in the management of COVID itself, I mean, you know, I hear of quite significant clinical progress. So I think it is clear that if clinicians knew today, if that knowledge could have been transported backwards, then I think some people who did sadly die may not have died. And that's been good learning, if you like, through the process. So I think in the round, it's done quite well in the handling of COVID. But there will be things to be looked at and to be learned.
So just to look at health and social care reform, in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about that and a series of independent reports, all making similar recommendations about the need for change in how and where care is provided. But there hasn't been much progress in implementing actual change in response. You've been in the midst of this. What do you think needs to happen to bring about real, much needed reform?
I think the first thing is that as a society in Northern Ireland, we have to give permission to make change. You know, often when you talk about change, everybody will say, yes, that's a good thing. It's going to be for the better. And then as soon as you actually describe where you're going to make a change, you're in court or there's a dispute or there's a whole, you know, razzmatazz in the media about it. So I think one of the things as a society we have to do is we have to give permission to make the changes. And, you know, having reflected on it and having been involved in it, I think there are a number of things that need to be carefully thought through. How do politicians react to change? How do professions react to change? How do the citizens react to change? Do people react to change? What about the cost of change? And what about how it's presented in a public relations way? I mean, for me, I sometimes think of it of the five Ps: politics, professions, people, pounds, and PR. You know, in the politics of it all, you get a lot of concern locally because politicians always are looking to be elected. Even at the time of, if you like, non-election campaigns, the hot war of elections, the 3 to 6 months before an election, they're concerned about elections. And the health system, as a general rule from a political point of view, doesn't often get you elected, but as sure as shooting, it will get you deselected. And I think that is a problem for our local politicians. Many of them want to make the change, but they have an eye on how they get to be elected and how does that get read in the constituency area that they're in. Our professions are brilliant. We have, you know, we are so much better off because of our professions. But don't mistake the fact that professions have a very dark side. You know, they are interested in power, influence, and control, and they will look at change to see whether that interferes with their power, their influence and control, and they will not always work with you in terms of the change. For example, the Royal College of Surgeons in Northern Ireland would probably tell you you only need about 3 or 4 emergency surgical units, but if you talk to individual surgeons working all over the place, they would throw their hands up at that. And the next thing is they appear in the local press and they are saying we don't agree with this and all of that. It makes it really, really quite difficult. And for people, I think, you know, permission is not something that you get in an absolute term. Most people want to do a good thing in health, but they do want their own circumstances sorted out first. And they'll give you permission to make change, but they will reserve their right to withdraw that permission if they don't like the change or they don't like how it's unfolding. And particularly if they think the change is making their life more difficult and making the professionals and the system's lives easier. We have a complicated thing about money. Everybody reduces the failure to make change to money. But actually, in my experience, that's not right. You know, you can have too much money. You can have too little money. What is the right amount of money in the midst of all of this? But you do need to know that when you're making change for a short period of time, you're running two services. So it will cost more. And you need to have that transition funding to enable that to occur. And of course, in the midst of all of this, you get a whole public discourse about how it's happening and why it's happening. And most of what happens in that situation is it's not the 95% of things that are going well and happening, it's the 5% of things that are difficult. And that can be really disabling because it can take away time, it can draw politicians into that whole period, it can take professional staff away. And there are only 24 hours in a day, and you've got a choice as to how you make spend that time. So there is a complicated little interplay of these things. And I think for us to really make sure that we want change, we have to understand that. And then we have to understand the evidence for change. And we just have to be clear about the evidence for change. I mean, there's currently consultation out for stroke units. It's probably the case that in Northern Ireland, we should have three. That will mean the closure of some stroke services. And I fully expect that to be resisted very strongly, locally and professionally. And, you know, yet the truth of the matter in absolute terms is if you want more people to survive after they've had a stroke and be less disabled, then the relocation into three stroke services is probably the way to go. Consider the cancer services. You know, some 20 years ago when they were relocated, everybody thought it was the end of the world. Nowadays, no one would consider going back from the cancer centre that we have in Belfast and Derry. Nobody would consider going back to the old way of handling these things. So there are really quite big and profound changes. And behind it all, one thing that always gets in the way is employment. The health service is a massive employer, and particularly as you go from east to west in the province, it is often the largest employer. And change means change in employment. And you can get lots and lots of opposition to change because of that employment issue.
So thinking in particular about waiting lists as a current presenting issue that is really impacting on many people's lives. We talked about the new waiting list figures out last week and showed again that waiting lists in Northern Ireland are really off the scale compared to the rest of the UK. How does the executive begin to address waiting lists that have grown even more because of COVID?
Well, there are a couple of things I would say. First of all, the current waiting lists are nothing short of a disgrace. There is no way you can describe them any other way than that. It's quite clear that some people will die waiting on waiting lists, and some people will have their life curtailed on the waiting lists as they currently sit. And also, some people who are on waiting lists will become very unwell and be admitted as emergencies, further adding to the confusion of waiting lists and elective care. It's taken about 6 years to get to this stage in the waiting times, and there is no prospect of coming out of it to anything normal in under about 5 years. So the first thing I think anyone who's in the ministerial job has to say just straightforwardly, I can't fix this in under about 5 years. There's no point in pretending you're going to fix it any sooner because it is not fixable in time less than that. It probably pushes us towards things like understanding what the waiting lists actually are. They're not just a big generic lump of numbers. You know, there are fractures, there are eye problems in terms of cataracts, there's general surgery problems, there are diagnostics, just to understand the makeup of those waiting lists and to have a program of action against each of them. Because the first thing you can do is get control. You know, they might not get any better, but you sure as shooting can stop them getting any worse. And that's the first step in mind, is to get control. And that probably means looking at driving the efficiency of the current system by 5 to 10%, coming into very radical changes about and separations of emergency and elective care, and probably buying extra resource either from the independent sector or from more formal arrangements with other health systems in the UK or down south where they have got the capacity to give you a bit of additional activity. Because otherwise, you're just asking people to wait. And the simple fact is that in Northern Ireland, we've had almost what we would probably call an explosion in private care as a consequence. So the very thing that people don't want to do, which is create a double service and a two standard service, has been created by waiting lists. That's why it's so important to get the waiting lists into a different place than they currently are. We need new pathways in primary care. You know, 25% of patients going to see their GP go with back issues. the vast majority do not need to go immediately to orthopedic surgeons and onto lists. They need to go to physio and to get assessments and professional assessments. Same with mental health and those sorts of issues. So there are ways of doing it, but the overriding issue is to just be straightforward and to be honest and tell the public. Because I don't think we have waiting lists anymore. I think we just have lists. You know, if you're asking people to wait 1, 2, 3, and you hear the odd time of, you know, like horror stories of that 3-year waiting list, they're not on a waiting list. They're just on some list, which someday might bring them to a hospital system. It's not relevant to talk about it as a waiting list anymore. And the other thing that I think is really important for the whole of the health system, both waiting lists and its reform, is that it will have to, of course, be very responsible about managing COVID and preparing for COVID. But COVID can't be used as an excuse for not doing something more significant than waiting lists, or as an excuse for not reforming our services. It really, you know, it can't get itself into that place. That's really important.
Yeah. Thanks, Sean. I think there's several podcasts in just talking about health and social care, but we do need to move on. I think from your answers there, I think have given us loads to consider, you know, the very challenging situation in health and social care into which COVID arrived. And so now there's the situation of dealing with COVID, but then also starting to address the ever-growing waiting lists and the need for reform. And I think I was really struck there by what you said about reform needs support and indeed discussion and much more engagement across the whole of society, really, from politicians, professionals, and the public. That everyone needs to be thinking about this and thinking about the actual impact of change in health and what it might mean for how health is delivered for all of us day to day. So I'm going to move on now to talk about education, to speak to Jane Thompson, who's the head of Parentkind in Northern Ireland, an organisation she's worked for since 2007. During this time, Jane has championed parent voice on every level as an advocate for parents in the education sphere. Jane has worked directly with parents and children for well over 20 years and is expert in helping navigate homeschool relationships. She's a champion for more active engagement of parents in children's education and in schools. So it's back to school this week or last week for children and young people, with teachers welcoming children back after many months of empty classrooms. Children eager on the whole to return to a more normal school life and learning. And many parents breathing a sigh of relief after 23 weeks without school. But it's also clear this is no normal September back to school. Children will have new hygiene and distancing rules in school. Movement and mixing in school will be restricted, and over all this hangs the prospect of further disruption in the months ahead. And all of those practical details are before we begin to consider the impact of the months without school on children's well-being and learning, and how they can be supported to recover from that where needed. So Jane, just starting off with that issue, what do we know about the impact of lockdown on children and young people?
Well, first of all, thank you, Anne, for inviting me on today. What do we know about the impact of lockdown on children and young people? Well, to be honest, we don't actually know the true extent of the impact of lockdown yet on children and young people. And I suspect it may be a fair few years before we actually do. If we look at in 2013, when Sprang and Silliman illustrated that after the 2009 influenza A pandemic in the USA, that the post-traumatic stress scores were 4 times higher in children who had been quarantined than in children who hadn't been. So the true extent of the impact in terms of the impact on children's psychological well-being, as well as their missed learning and ability to re-engage with their peers and ability in this new norm, it's not yet realised. We know from parents that their fears that lockdown will have impacted greatly on children's mental health, and also for them to re-familiarise themselves with so much, including the routine of the school day, friendships, along with the motivation and desire to start learning again. And we must not also forget the children who have experienced a COVID bereavement in the family. and missed out of the traditional mourning process that we're so attached to here in Northern Ireland. And the other big worry is for children who are afraid of the virus, afraid of going to school in case they catch it, or afraid they will carry it home to a family member who is vulnerable due to age, health condition, or other. My worry also is, what new assessment processes have we in place that we can assess and identify the level and variations of need on the return to school post-school lockdown?
So I said at the start that this isn't a normal September back to school. And how should the priorities be different as children and young people go back to school this week?
At Parentkind, we asked parents what exactly did they feel that the priorities should be. And I'll just run through the top responses that they gave us here. So in Northern Ireland, 68% of parents said that the priority for school, that schools should be focusing on, is mental well-being. That was followed at 64% by curriculum learning, followed at 49% by establishing rebuilding relationships with peers and staff. And then at just under 20%, at 19.5% and 18.5%, was social skills, making sense of COVID, including coping with bereavement and change. And then there were some others. But again, I go back to the assessment process for the mental health, because we need to have a robust assessment process in place to enable us garner a clear understanding of the needs, the additional impact of COVID and school closures before we can begin to address the issue and support their children and their families. Parentkind welcomed the additional investment the Minister of Education announced to support wellbeing in schools, but we would also like to see how that will be divided up and how far it will go, because we know that there were glaring gaps in funding for mental health provision in schools before COVID, in particular in primary schools, who have been calling out for funding for counselling for children. Secondly, as parents reported to us, missed learning. Of course, this is a massive area, it's huge, that will need to be looked at. And we are concerned about the proposal as part of the CCEA, GCSE and AAS level consultation, how some subjects are remaining at 100% in comparison to others that have been reduced by 30 to 40%, because that leaves little wriggle room for catch up on missed learning, or indeed if children miss school again this term. This is putting additional pressure on teachers and on children, and we don't yet know how that will ripple down to the years underneath as well. So that is a concern for us and a priority area along with mental health, which needs to be greatly examined at the moment.
So do you think there's sufficient support in place to help children and young people as they return to school? Thinking especially of those who might have struggled during lockdown. I know the executive have announced a number of additional funding streams which were happening over the summer and then for the coming academic year. Is that sufficient or is more needed?
If we were to ask each of the schools this question at the moment, then I anticipate that we would be very definitely told no, that there isn't enough. And if we drill down into the individual gaps, I suspect that within some schools there'd be a lot of similarities, but there also would be variations. I feel that within the next few weeks, we will have greater clarity as to what areas most need funding and are needing additional support. We fear that one area at the moment will be a huge need of increased support will be for mental health. We have heard from parents, they're concerned about the impact of school closures on their child's mental health, including new things such as transitional anxiety, moving to school, resettling children back in, particularly those children with SEN who are going to be having a change in teacher or classroom assistant, and indeed the new school day as well, without having had any preparation for this. Also, children not having engaged with friends, forgetting how to engage. But until we understand what the gaps are and what the impact of school closures have been, it is then that we will be greater able to understand where the gaps are that were needed to be plugged and what we need additional support with. One of the areas causing huge concern, obviously, is for SEN. There were a backlog indeed there of statements, and we know that that has increased. Parents, teachers and students are telling us about their real worry about this and how quickly this is going to be addressed on the return to school. But we are hopeful that with the department having allocated the £11 million through Engage, that it will be enough to cover each of these identified areas of need.
And just to finally, from you, Jane, one controversial but very important issue is the post-primary transfer process. Now, I note that you've mentioned the consultation that's ongoing about the content of GCSE and A-level courses next summer. There's also been a debate in England just in the last few days about whether GCSEs and A-levels should be delayed later than they normally take place in the spring. But meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, we are heading into a post-primary transfer process and tests in November, which have been delayed by just a couple of weeks. How are children and parents feeling about the transfer tests coming up in November?
To be honest, Anne, the feelings are very, very mixed. Some parents feel that it shouldn't happen this year. Some believe it should go ahead as planned in November, December. And others feel that it should be postponed until after Christmas. Many of the parents who had children due to sit the test, but their post-primary school have pulled it, have reported that they're not happy with the alternative criteria, as they feel the top options will automatically deny their child a place. And they would have preferred that their child had the opportunity to sit the test. So we represent all parents, and you know, the feelings are genuinely very mixed across the whole of the North. The Education Committee are surveying parents and teachers on the transfer and alternative criteria, and I believe that this will provide really clear insight to both parents and teachers' views on it for this year alone.
Great. Thank you, Jane. Some really important issues there. I think what came across clearly to me is the need for clear assessment of where children and young people are when they return to school, and then the appropriate tailored support for them, particularly thinking about support for those who might have struggled during lockdown and may struggle with the readjustment to school again. And of course, you know, you can talk about being behind with learning, but actually if a child or a young person's not in a good place in their well-being, then their learning's not going to happen effectively. So some very important issues there. And I think clearly there, Jane, you're saying we need the evidence on what is the need as children return from school. And then we would hope that the right provision and support will be in place for them. So thank you, Jane. I'm going to move on now and talk to Richard Johnston, who is the Deputy Director of Ulster University's Economic Policy Centre and has almost 20 years of economic policy experience. Richard provides economic and policy advice to government officials, ministers and businesses on a range of research areas. So thinking about the economy, Northern Ireland experienced low rates of COVID in terms of cases and deaths compared to the rest of the UK, but the economic impact of COVID is expected to be much more severe than elsewhere, with a longer and a slower recovery. Richard, what impact do we expect the COVID downturn to have on the Northern Ireland economy, and which sectors and groups are most affected?
Anne, and thank you for the opportunity to chat here today about the impact of COVID and what that means for broad groups across the economy. So we reckon that the impact so far has been to contract the economy by 12 to 13%. This is the deepest and most rapid recession in Northern Ireland's history. It took the last recession about five quarters to unfold fully in around 5 or 6% contraction. And realistically, this recession happened within 3 to 4 weeks. We reckon that it's going to take 5 to 10 years to fully recover across a range of indicators. And if we even look back to 2008, it did take between 5 and 10 years at that stage to recover from some of those more significant economic impacts. So output, for example, only get back to pre-recession levels in 2016. In terms of sectors, tourism, hospitality, arts and culture, admin, retail and wholesale, and aerospace manufacture are all sectors that have been significantly impacted. They've been impacted in different ways. So tourism, hospitality, arts and culture, for instance, have been impacted by the fact that we can't carry out our face-to-face activities. We can't gather in large groups. We don't necessarily take the holidays or take the evenings out that we used to take as a society. In terms of aerospace, as Mark will know, that's been severely impacted because airlines have put back their purchases and their maintenance schedules. So that's impacted in the aerospace sector significantly in Northern Ireland. In terms of vulnerable groups, Ryan Hogg and I produced a paper about a month ago, and we would reckon that there are about 230,000 jobs that remain vulnerable. There were 212,000 people on the coronavirus job retention scheme. You know, and even as an illustration, if just 20% of the people on that scheme become redundant later in the year when it ends, we will see unemployment levels of well over 100,000. And already we're back to unemployment levels that we saw in around the late 1990s when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. And unfortunately, if we step up in unemployment much more, it will look like an economy of the 80s where unemployment gets back to sort of very significant levels at 120,000 or so. The groups that are most impacted are the young, as they struggle to get into the labour force, they struggle to get their first job, they struggle to get their career off the ground. Those with low formal qualifications and consequently lower incomes are also the most significantly impacted. So if you think about the types of jobs in the sectors that we talked about, tourism, hospitality, arts and culture, admin and retail, so a lot of shop front staff, a lot of restaurant staff, a lot of hotel staff, front of house, all of those sorts of things. Interestingly, meals are more impacted by the recession because they're more highly represented in the labour market, and part-timers and those who work in rural areas. So those who are on sort of contracts that are less stable or less long-term are those that would be impacted most. The council areas in around Belfast actually are in some of the strongest positions going into the recession and are some of the most insulated as well. So realistically, it's interesting to watch the areas that are with high concentrations of tourism, retail or manufacturing, and those are the areas that have been hit most. So areas like Mid-Ulster and Fermanagh and Omagh.
So how would you describe the Northern Ireland economy before COVID? What were its strengths and weaknesses?
Well, if we look at Northern Ireland in terms of strengths, I think in a historical perspective, Northern Ireland really hadn't performed that well in its history. So our quality of life was very good. Levels of recorded well-being were very high, despite some of the other economic indicators suggesting that that was a bit of an anomaly. We had very good environmental impact indicators. So the likes of CO2 emissions were very low. Those are very good things to have for an economy. In terms of record setting, we had record highs in terms of output, GVA, wages and profits. We had record highs in terms of employment, wages, R&D, exports. And we also had record lows in terms of unemployment. So in a historical context, it was very strong. The commuter council areas around Belfast certainly seemed to have quite a very few economic problems. And whilst there were areas of deprivation within those areas, it was a very good time for Northern Ireland in terms of its economic performance. So maybe economic development had slipped down the agenda slightly over the last couple of years, and we created a significant number of jobs. If we change tack to look at the weaknesses, I think this is where we would look at Northern Ireland in a relative sense. So how do we perform against our competitor nations? How do we perform against Ireland, other parts of the UK, etc.? One of our main challenges is that we have low levels of productivity and lower levels of competitiveness. that concerns us as economists, because in the long run, if you're not competitive, you can't generate money from outside Northern Ireland. And that's how you'll grow the economy, is effectively by bringing in more business investment, exporting and selling outside Northern Ireland. Or you can also grow your economy through subvention as well, through Treasury subvention. Our competitor nations are overtaking us in terms of skills, in terms of physical infrastructure, innovation, inactivity, childcare costs, labour supply. So across a range of those indicators, it is quite concerning to us that we would see some of the former Eastern European nations beginning, for instance, to move ahead of Northern Ireland in terms of skills. So scientific ability, numeracy, and literacy, we would see some of those nations, and especially Estonia, who can generate very, very good educational returns to lower amounts of spend per pupil. And those are areas that we need to look at and work out exactly how they're getting the returns and generating that level of value for money and creating future and digitally focused skills that will set them up in a good competitive frame for the future.
So just building on that, people have described COVID as a disruptor and that it might be an opportunity to start doing things differently. So in what ways might this be an opportunity for the Northern Ireland Executive to take a different approach in its support for the economy? What could it do differently?
Absolutely. So with every crisis comes opportunity. So there are certainly going to be opportunities with this recession. There are going to be winners and losers. You know, we've seen those who can sell online. Some of them are effectively having a K-shaped recovery, where the more online-able companies are actually, they're surging ahead. So the likes of Amazon. Others, in terms of tourism, potentially are moving down the ladder. So it's a bit of a K-shaped recovery where areas are doing well and other areas aren't. But what I would say, in terms of what the executive could do differently, we have £2 billion of additional spending in Northern Ireland that we didn't have last year. That's across the CGRS scheme, self-employment scheme, and across the additional DEL departmental expenditure that the executive has. So there is extra finance available to do additional things or do things differently. What I would also say is that policymakers across government are already heavily engaged. So I haven't talked to one policymaker who isn't trying to make a better place of Northern Ireland. I think what we need to do, we need to focus on outcomes rather than inputs like spending. We need to prioritise programmes and projects that increase wellbeing or quality of life the most. And as some of our previous speakers have said, we need to consider duplication right across Northern Ireland. So whether that's in health or education or other parts of government, we need to be clear that there are areas of some duplication that potentially could save a number of pounds that could be used in other areas. We need to evaluate what works well. We need to do that relentlessly. And we need to be very honest and very clear with ourselves about the things that work well and the items and policies and programmes that have the most impact. I'm not saying that we should absolutely stop doing any certain part of activity that government takes forward, but certainly there are some things we could do less of and focus on the things that have the biggest bang for our buck. But in order to do that, we need to have good evidence that needs to be robust, and we need to actually move forward on that basis. The other thing we need to do is manage risk appropriately. We need to acknowledge that risk cannot ever be entirely removed. So whatever program we take forward, whatever project we take forward, there will be some risk that some of that will go wrong. And in a post RHI environment, we need to be careful that we don't avoid taking all risks. We need to manage risk appropriately and understand that some things will fail. And as long as they're taken forward in an environment where people are objective and clear about what they're approving, they understand the risks, I think that's all fine. So there are a number of things the executive could do differently in there, but some of it's cultural, some of it's policy focused. And I think, you know, from what I've seen so far, there's an awful lot of work going on behind the scenes to make sure that Northern Ireland does make the most of the opportunities that might be presented from the crisis.
So I think you've already begun to touch on my last question. Going forward, there's going to be more of a focus than ever on getting the most out of the public funding that's available in Northern Ireland. What steps does the executive need to take to get the most out of the funding allocation that we receive?
Yeah. I think that's absolutely correct. We need to make hay while the sun shines effectively with the money that we have at this point in time, because we're already starting to see conversations looking at the longer term and the tax environment and the spend environment to say, well, taxes are going to have to increase very shortly to begin to pay some of the COVID debt off. So UK national debt now exceeds 2 trillion. What it would say is that we have 2 million people in Northern Ireland, almost 2 million. It's not a huge region or country by any stretch of the imagination. So we should be agile. We should be well-informed. We should have good information about what we're doing in Northern Ireland across the piece. As I said, duplication, whether it's health, education or anywhere else, we need to begin to have honest conversations and very, quite challenging conversations there about how we may remove some of that duplication. And as John has said, it's not an easy process. It's going to take maybe 5 or more years to really get to that point. I also think it would be useful to have a zero-based budget review. So all areas, all spend. And, you know, a line-by-line and board snip that was carried out in the South in 2008. Look at all the areas of spend right across government. Is there anything that we're doing that we don't absolutely need to do? You know, and then a prioritisation in terms of where we absolutely have to take something forward, whether it's nice to do, whether it's something that we'll get a lot of pressure if we don't do it from the various groups across society. And the other thing I would say, absolutely relentless use of technology and digitisation across government. We've seen how we can pivot services very quickly. We can deliver lots of things from home, from outside the office environment. And that's freed up staff to do other things that possibly they couldn't have done in the past. The use of tech within some sectors has accelerated by around a decade, according to some reports, certainly in retail. And if we look at government, if we take the technological disruption forward by a decade, certainly speaking as someone who works in a university, what we've been able to do within a few weeks to get all of the modules online, all of the examinations changed to coursework, and actually deliver that term and get through that process has been monumental. So I think there has to be an absolutely relentless focus on where the benefits from technology lie. The last thing I would say is competitiveness is absolutely the bottom line for me. It's as important to economic development as gravity is to physics. So you'll hear me saying that an awful lot. I can't emphasize how important competitiveness is, because if we want to grow as a society, we want to generate money from abroad, we want to have more income to spread around, you know, that is what we'll absolutely have to focus on. So how do we become more competitive in an international environment will be key.
Thank you, Richard. I think, I suppose, a quite bleak picture there about the economic impact of COVID, but actually also quite a positive and hopeful story in terms of the things that the executive could focus on, like a greater use of evidence and being relentless on concentrating on what works, looking at public expenditure and seeing where it's most effective and actually where it may not be, which ties in with some of the things we talked about earlier, and having those honest conversations about spending and prioritisation. And I think then as well, you ended there talking about the importance of focusing on technology and getting the best from technology, both individually, but then for businesses and Northern Ireland as a whole, and a clear focus on competitiveness. So thank you, Richard, for that. Our final panel member today is Mark Huddleston. Mark is Managing Director of JHE Solutions and King & Fowler UK. With a background in advanced manufacturing and engineering, Mark has worked in a range of startups, SMEs, and multinational businesses. Mark has been a member of the Matrix panel for science and innovation and of a range of skills panels, both locally and nationally. He was Northern Ireland Commissioner on the UK's Commission for Employment and Skills. So government nationally and locally took immediate and intensive action to address the immediate impact of COVID, like the furlough scheme, grants to businesses, business rates relief and so on. And much of that's now tapering off with an expectation of a return to some kind of a normal, but normal may be a long way off for many firms. Mark, what action do businesses want from the executive to support the recovery from COVID? What's your view on what the executive's done so far to help business?
Thanks, Sean. Maybe take that in reverse order. In terms of what the executive and the wider UK government have done, I think it's hard to not congratulate them and say that it's been positive. That the speed that it happened at was certainly necessary. And for a large proportion of the business community, it had an immediate positive impact. It addressed the short-term liquidity issues that many businesses were facing. However, like everybody has said, you know, there's gaps in the response, and we've seen some frustration from self-employed, director-owned small businesses who have fallen through the cracks and are now really hurting. And I think that's seen by the decline even over the COVID period of those that are self-employed. In terms of what could the executive do now as a next step, I think probably the first thing is to try and look at the proliferation of some of the options, and maybe that has followed some of the political circumstances, but we've now seen various departments all come out with, you know, a range of small schemes with different focus and different options, and it may be that they need funneled back into something that's slightly more cohesive in terms of the approach. The other element for Stormont is the impact of what will be decided at Westminster and what's coming down the tracks there. There's a major debate now happening over what is the right way forward. Do we fund and continue to support growth, or do we start to tax and address the challenges coming from the record debt levels that the country faces? So a lot of what will happen next will depend on how Rishi Sunak approaches corporation tax, capital allowances, national living wage, capital gains and entrepreneurs relief, the apprenticeship levy, R&D tax credits. There's a list as long as your arm there that really is a Westminster decision, and then will have a knock-on effect on what Richard has really pointed out is a very weak and you know, challenging situation here economically in Northern Ireland. I think from a local perspective, there's probably some very quick short-term activity. By funneling some of the activity, the Department for the Economy could look at, you know, very quickly how it utilises the underspend that it's had on grant support, which is not inconsiderable. And the other immediate impact that could help is getting the apprenticeship funding package of 17.2 million that's been announced over the last 3 weeks, getting the detail of that out so businesses can start to, you know, advertise or ensure that the unravelling of the job retention scheme doesn't impact apprentices that they're really employing. We've seen the start of the infrastructure review. I think that's going to be critical for certain sectors, that it can create very quick opportunities that could enable business activity to pick up quite quickly. We know the challenges we have around our water infrastructure. There's a social housing deficit. There is the roads infrastructure, particularly west of the Ban, and we've challenges around power generation. So from a business perspective, depending on your sector, there's opportunities there that the executive could pay a very quick part in and utilise their purchasing power to support. Digital infrastructure is another one, which, you know, a quick change in digital infrastructure and progressing on super fast fibre and 5G. I think certain other cities and regions in the UK are already seeing the benefit of that. And probably the last thing is a very clear direction on the industrial strategy. What is the next steps that the executive is going to take so that business can plan its investment around that?
So from what Richard said, we know particular groups are especially hard hit by COVID in terms of the economic impact. So Richard mentioned young people, people with lower qualifications, people in lower paid jobs. From your perspective, what particular action does the executive need to take to help these groups?
I think the first and most immediate thing is that it needs to be an executive cross-cutting response to be effective. It needs to be something that the entire executive and potentially like what's happening in Scotland, where the, you know, Nicola Sturgeon is owning the some of the project activity there around this. It needs to be led through the executive office rather than having individual separate departments driving it. How the response should move forward from there, I think, splits it into some responses from business to it and then some responses to support individuals. And this is where the complexity of the solution could potentially create a few stumbling blocks, because what we're looking at is essentially a paradigm shift in thinking here. From a business perspective, the executive needs to look at where there is sustainable business models and help bridge the gap to sustainability. There are some sectors where the sector is going to look very different post-COVID, but elements of that sector, you know, can return and return in a way that will support the competitive issue and the productivity issues that Richard has rightly pointed out. We've mentioned procurement policy. I think that is going to play a key part. Changing procurement policy from a lowest price as a key measure to some other matrix will help, particularly in the manufacturing sector in Northern Ireland, to potentially gain opportunities within procurement rather than miss out due to cost. And you know, another thing from a business perspective is that Invest in AI maybe gets a short-term repurposing from job creation to job retention and business sustainability. All these, alongside a greater emphasis on social partnership, I think would help from a business perspective to support those that you've mentioned there, Anne. I think from an individual perspective, for those that maybe fall into that youth or lower skill, lower paid category, there is potentially an immediate challenge for them in the how do they access some of the support that's being made available. The quality of training that they receive therefore is absolutely essential. So whether that's in the school setting or an FE college in university or wherever that may be, we need to ensure that the quality, and I think, you know, as Richard touched on some of the issues and opportunities that come from countries like Estonia at the moment, there's a lot of learning we can do as to how they have achieved those outcomes. Help and direction towards immediate employment through a combination of skills development and recognition that certain sectors which have been under-supported and under-utilised could help. We've got a likeliness that we're going to see extremes in skill requirement here. So how do we bridge that? We're going to see a lot of push for graduate level roles as we move to a more digital knowledge-based economy. And then we're going to see, you know, what potentially and historically have been argued to be low-skilled jobs, but of high value, which around, you know, what John touched on earlier, health and social care, and the need to, particularly around domiciliary care, potentially change our approach there. There's the professionalisation then of roles like we have in health and social care. How do we support that enables young people with low skills and low pay to potentially see greater progression opportunities within those roles? We've seen a real push in both the Republic of Ireland and in Scotland around what good work looks like and how do we develop good work for, you know, particularly young people. So how do we support that 16 to 24 demographic? And potentially that leads to the question of how do we use the Belfast City Region deal and other city deals that we've achieved in Northern Ireland and maybe repurpose them slightly away from some of the big ticket price projects to help them have an immediate impact and deliver a greater outcome for those that come from those particular backgrounds.
Great. Thank you, Martin. I'm just going to ask you one more question, which is, I know you've got a particular interest and expertise in skills. Thinking about young people coming through school now, what should be the executive's focus in order to best prepare them for jobs of the future?
Jobs of the future is a difficult one to try and project. We've got a real conundrum as to what the economy is going to look like going forward. is there going to be a greater level of innovation and digital adoption? Are we going to see that sort of two-tier approach that has potentially emerged over the last few years where we have essentially a haves and have-nots scenario? But I think the first thing I would say is we need to be radical. We're going to have to prepare young people for a much more entrepreneurial world where lifelong learning is the norm. They're going to not only gain knowledge, which is still the core function of our education system in Northern Ireland, but also how to use it and apply it. We're going to see a real change, and Richard's already alluded to it, as to how we learn. But we're also going to have to change how those that are going to be our educators in the future operate. So, that seismic shift that we're looking at is going to have to start within the teacher training colleges. Our curriculum is going to have to look different. How we operate within the classroom or outside the classroom, depending on what level of digital adoption we take on, is going to require very detailed planning. It's going to have to happen quickly. And it's also going to have to be something that we're prepared to work on for the long term. John touched on it earlier around political cycles. We're going to have to take it and make it an apolitical issue in terms of the reform of how we develop those skills. Preparing our young people for all that is something that we've struggled with. And Richard has rightly pointed out that there are opportunities. Jane has rightly pointed out that there needs to be a wider dialogue about this. Some of the immediate things that can be done there is the 14 to 19 year old education strategy, which understandably has been shelved for the last 8 to 9 months, must come to the forefront, must be properly and significantly invested in, both in terms of time and effort to create opportunity. And that also needs to bring various departments together, where previously it's been very much a Department for Education project. There are other major challenges. What is the future of the GCSE qualification? How do we create priority of esteem between vocational and academic outcomes and build those pathways? We're seeing job guarantee schemes coming out of Scotland at the moment as they prepare for a new programme for government. Whatever is going to happen, it goes back to some of the points everybody else has made around measuring outcomes and not the activity.
Thank you, Mark, for giving us some radical ideas there about the future of education for our young people, which requires imagination and ambition as we think about preparing them for the future, and how they're taught in schools might need to change as a result of that. And also, Mark gave us, I think, some good ambition in terms of further support that could come from the executive as businesses recover from COVID, and particularly was challenging about the need for coherence between the responses from different executive departments and how that fits with the response from Westminster. But I think overall he's saying, as others have said, that actually now there is an opportunity because there is funding available to support the recovery from COVID. So the executive needs to make the very best of that opportunity. So thank you, Mark. That brings us to the end of our discussion today. It's been really interesting, very wide ranging on different topics and issues. I think the themes that have come across to me, just to pick out a few, I think very clearly all our speakers are talking about tackling longer term issues, not just looking at immediate problems, and how the executive needs to be much longer sighted in how it prepares its work programme. The executives handled COVID well and handled the impact of COVID well, but they need to look to the longer term and make those difficult decisions for the future. And often that means taking the politics out of it and looking for the tough choices that will set Northern Ireland up for the future in terms of public service reform, reducing the duplication of public services and so on. And there was a clear call as well to get the very best from the funding that is available, particularly the funding that's available to support the COVID recovery, but also all the funding that comes in to Northern Ireland, and being quite tough about looking at what is the most effective and what is getting the best value. And I think another clear message from all of our speakers was the importance of evidence and evaluation about what works, and focusing on what we know is most effective in how spending is used. So can I say thank you to our panel as we finish? Thank you to John Compton, Jane Thompson, Richard Johnston and Mark Huddleston. Really appreciate your time and your insights today. I hope our listeners found it interesting. Please do have a look on Pivotal's website for the report we published this week on policy priorities for the Northern Ireland Executive. You can also find earlier Pivotal reports and podcasts on the website. One of our aims, as I said at the start, is to get more people talking about public policy issues in Northern Ireland. So do get in touch with Pivotal on Twitter or via our website. We'd love to hear your views on this and other issues. Thanks for listening today.